Hi everyone, this is Gilad.
This is Nathan.
And we are here at Bike Banter, here with you once a week, every Thursday. Please join us for some fun bike talk.
It's recording!
Now, are you sure about that? Because yesterday...
So, okay. So, we actually recorded an episode yesterday. It's coming a day later for everyone because we actually did the work. After our work day, Nathan and I came in the office, my wife's office, where we record every week, and we spent about an hour and 10 minutes of really good episode for everyone, and it messed up.
But so, as magic would have it, yes, it's even better because of that.
Sure.
Right?
Well, I don't know. It might be horrible.
Well, no, because of our guests.
I know, but our guests could be horrible.
I don't think so.
We don't know. We just met him. Like, don't assume.
Yeah, but he's already got radio voice.
He does have radio voice. Do you want to tell people who you are?
Do I need to introduce myself?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
All right. Now. I'm Jimmy Mack, and you might know me as Jimmy Mack from Mountain Bike Action Magazine.
Wait.
And I just want to say up front that I'm not offended that they asked me to come on the podcast after they erased a total podcast. So I'm just as good as an erased podcast, I guess.
No, to be fair, we would have actually done this anyway and then used it for next week's
show. Sure. Absolutely.
We would have banked it. Yeah, we would have banked it.
Yeah, we would have just dropped it next
week. We wouldn't have missed this opportunity.
Jimmy.
But thank you.
You've also worked for other places too, right? Not just Mountain Bike Action, but
no, actually, Mountain Bike Action was like the last stop on my career. Mm-hmm. So it goes back a long way. I've worked for Suzuki Motorcycles and for JT Racing, Troy Lee Designs. I got to work for those
amazing
guys.
You know, he's the first guest we had that's hold the mic correctly. Do you notice that?
Yeah, I told him.
You told him how to hold the mic?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he's like a pro.
He is a pro.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I didn't have to tell him, but.
By the way, you can sit back.
I want this to sound good.
No, but you can sit back, chill, legs up. Like, we gave you the special.
I could fall asleep. I might start.
It's fine.
I might start snoring.
The man's a professional. Let him do what he does.
I just want him to be comfortable. So
anyway, hold it back. So I worked for some companies inside the motorcycle and bicycle industry, and then through a longtime friend, Jody Weisel, he's still editor of Motocross Action magazine, mm-hmm, he hired me to do Road Bike Action, the first version of it, which only lasted a few years. Then I did a magazine called Motocross Journal, and then luckily I got switched over to Mount Bike Action, and that's where I really found my stride.
When was that? Like that early 90s? No,
it would be 2001, 2002, in there when I went to Mountain Bike Action.
Oh, when you worked there, but Mountain Bike Action already existed.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, I mean, because I used to read it. I mean, so I'm Israeli. Mountain Bike Action for me was like, I don't know, like probably like how someone from India today sees something on the internet,
uh-huh,
and it's like, I will never see that ever in my life, right? Like when you see a Ferrari when you were a kid.
Yeah.
But if you're from India, that's kind of like, those bikes were unobtainium for me, the things I would see. Because also the worst thing I saw in Mountain Bike Action was the advertising for parts.
Uh-huh.
So like all the, what was the store, the really big store that
got, well, you had Cambria Bike Shop. Yeah.
Cambria, what was the other one?
There were so many.
Like Pro, they something were, Pro. What's the name of that shop? Like really, in the 2000s it was big. Yeah, you say it.
Yeah, say it.
There was Bike Nash Bar.
Oh yeah, Bike Nash Bar was a big one.
What was the other one?
And you had
anyway, so for me, like, it was magic. Getting that magazine was magical.
Yeah. Yep. And before the internet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. There was no other way to get information. Yeah. And oh my god, like we love to talk about Interbike, like it's gone as if like someone died.
Oh wait, Super Go. We cannot have this broadcast without mentioning Super Go.
Super Go. Thank you.
Alan Goldsmith, amazing retailer. Yeah. Just a great guy and very supportive of Mountain Bike Action for years.
Yeah. So Super Go was like, because it was like small letters and it was like tiny pictures.
Yeah, I remember those. I remember those ads.
And you would just like, oh my God, it's so cool.
But what you guys would find interesting is he also had a retail location.
Sure,
I've been to Santa Monica.
Yep.
And you would walk in and there would be 200 forks for sale.
Yeah.
If you and clothing, whatever size you needed, whatever brand you wanted, he had at their stocks. Yeah. So it was amazing.
So give us like a little backstory of, so do you get to the magazine because you were writing, because you loved bikes, or because they needed you to manage it? What was the how did you get into it?
You know, I would say a little bit of all that.
Okay.
You know, it's I had a passion for mountain biking. I was around when Steve Tilford, who is a very close personal friend, may he rest in peace, Godspeed, Steve Tilford, when he won the first Norba National. And I was helping him pit. He would stay at my house when he came west. And right there, I just got hooked on the sport.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I had been a roadie before that.
Stories, or did you watch him win? And then
I watched him win.
What year was this?
Oh, you can't ask me year.
Just for reference. I mean, the first Norba.
It's probably 84, 85. Because Alexi Graywall was also on that team.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was known for winning the gold medal at
GT?
He rode for the Levi's Raleigh team at the first Norba National. And what that was it was Moots mountain bikes painted up to look like Raleigh's.
Okay. Do you guys mind? So I don't have the depth of knowledge, and I think some of our audience don't have the depth of knowledge of, so this whole beginning of mountain biking thing. So like, this was a brand new sport, obviously.
Brand new.
Okay, yeah. So you come from motorcycles, and like, what attracts you? Like, you see this new sport, these quirky people with half motorcycle parts, half bike, like basically cruisers.
Yeah.
Right? Riding on dirt. Was it weird to you? Was it like, what was it actually?
Well, because my background was motocross.
Okay.
So for a motocrosser to go into mountain biking, it was like, it was such a natural transition. And I had also done velodrome racing and some road racing.
Why though?
Why is it a natural transition?
Why was it a natural transition?
Well, I think because...
What did you see in the sport? Like, okay, so I guess what I'm trying to say with this and is, like, you know when you hear a really good song for the first time?
Yeah.
And sometimes you recognize this is like, wow, this is a thing. And sometimes it's just something that passes you by and you need to hear it like 10 times before you actually get used to it.
Sure.
It sounds like this was the greatest hits basically hitting you, or this was like, what made you recognize that's good? It's not the next rollerblading, you know, something that's gonna come by and then go away.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back to, as a motocross racer, I was never that great. Okay. And then I started the road cycling in the velodrome, and I was sort of competitive. You know how when you get into the sport of cycling, if you put in the hours, you get some results out of it.
You're better than the people who don't put in the hours, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I started seeing results I never got on the motorcycle. And then when mountain bikes were, you know, invented, when it started to take off, I had those bike handling skills from motocross that a lot of the roadie guys didn't have yet. And so it was such a new sport, I was able to do pretty good at the beginning of that sport. And it was so rewarding. And the whole thing, you know, moving your legs and the breathing and all that, it was just great.
The breathing.
I try to do
that twice a day, breathing.
Well, if you've ever done a long climb, you know what I'm talking about. You know, you get into a rhythm.
I have to have that two-talk.
And apparently. It feels good.
So, I guess, So the microphone is a one-way, so it's here. So when you talk...
Okay, I'll try not to do that. Sorry.
No, you're good. No, I'm fine. I'm just telling you, like, the rules of the game. It makes sense, by the way. That way there's no sad noises. Like, you don't hear you on my mic.
Well, right? I keep looking at you guys. That's what throws you off. I guess I just got to look at the green
pretend
wall.
Pretend you got a sore neck. You got to go like this. Like, you got a pinched neck or something like that.
And by the way, again, our listeners is not exactly like a million people, so they're not... You know, we're not Joe Rogan here. There's no, like, nobody's going to fault you for it.
I don't know. This could be a step to Joe. Who knows?
He might
hear this.
Someone has millions of dollars.
Maybe he's one of our listeners.
That Jimmy Mack was so interesting. I got to get him on the broadcast.
Do you know that?
That radio voice. Wow.
Dude, he got $100 million for his show.
Huh?
Yeah. Wow. Like the satellite. What's the name of it? The thing you hear on your cars?
By the way, we tend to ramble quite a bit.
That's great.
Yeah, Sirius bought him for $100 million.
He deserves it. He deserves every penny.
Sure. Okay, so you see this new sport and you get hooked because you had some background from road biking.
Yeah.
Okay, but you were a rider by then, or you were...
No, I was still doing sales and marketing for different companies.
Okay, and so how do you go from that to being a journalist, which pays probably a lot more, right? Journalism is known to pay a lot more than
yeah, like,
sales,
like being a teacher
in big companies.
You know what I will say right now? I was very... fairly paid.
Really? From the beginning?
That's
good.
Yeah.
That's good.
So was Mountain Bike Action a part of a bigger organization? Yes. Always?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of magazines.
It's High Torque Publishing, mm-hmm. and they do Dirt Bike, they do Motocross Action, they do Mountain Bike Action, and those are their major titles, and Dirt Wheels for the ATV guys. And yeah.
They did Road Bike too, Road Bike Action.
Road Bike, that just recently closed down.
Is there E-Bike Action?
There was, and they just closed it.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Which... You know what? Just on the e-bike thing, it's now that they're so prevalent, it really should just be in a bicycle magazine.
Sure.
You know, you shouldn't have an electric motorcycle magazine or an electric bicycle magazine. Sure. It's just a bicycle magazine.
I think
magazine.
So many of the users are they're going to have an e-bike and a regular bike. You know,
like yeah,
it's not. And
well, I think they were thinking of it like cars. Like for a while, cars. Basically, people with electric cars are kind of not part of the regular car folks a lot of times, especially those magazines. A lot of time they do, like, you know, tinkering with your car stuff.
Sure.
And you don't really tinker with your Tesla.
I bet.
It's an appliance.
You know, I bet you at some point in time there's just like, there's so much new stuff coming out. We can't cover this properly in our normal magazine. And so
sure.
With all the normal stuff that you're covering too. And
For sure. And like, for me, it was more of a personal thing for me. I was not into e-bikes when they first came out.
I think a lot of, like, us acoustic riders had a problem with it at the beginning. We weren't sure what it is, really.
Yeah.
And I think all of us are definitely have changed, right?
They're fun. Yeah.
They're fun.
Well, yeah, I've lost the battle. I can say that.
You know, for you could be different. I think at the beginning, everyone told me that this is going to be the next thing. And nobody ever told me, like, until I had one, I never understood. No, it's just another thing. It's just the N+1 thing. It is different, and it's good different. And
yeah.
And the actually usage of, like, electric guitar versus acoustic is good because they both guitars, but they actually do it differently.
I think there's this weird thing that happens in maybe lots of places, but in the bike business for sure, where you get people who get afraid. They don't know they're afraid of this, but they're afraid that because this new technology comes out, it takes away something that they're used to, like completely familiar with and totally used to. Like a new grip design can come out and people will freak out about it because something about them is like, but then I can't get my ODI Ruffian lock-ons anymore.
Yeah.
And so they'll write bad reviews or they'll mouth off on the internet somewhere, like some forum somewhere, like Pinkbike. But they'll just go off on stuff like that because I think there's some way they're like defending their thing they like, you know?
Do you think it's a little bit of leftover from roadie? Because roadies resist everything.
Like yeah, that's true.
Yeah, painfully resist everything.
No, they do not. They do not resist lighter bikes and they do not resist more gears. Those two things, they do not resist.
Okay, I give you that.
But everything else, yes, they resist like crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. But they won't argue with lighter bikes and
correct
more gears.
I think what's important is that we use trails that are used by a number of different user groups. Mm-hmm. And I think we were very, very lucky to get as much access as we got with mountain bikes because they were so much faster than other trail user groups. So I just saw the e-bike thing as taking that up, mm-hmm. not a little notch, a gigantic notch. So you had trails that, you know, my wife and I would hike on.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, you know, a mountain biker comes by. Now with e-bikes or things that aren't even e-bikes, they're electric motorcycles. Mm. It's a lot scarier. And, you know, again, this your broadcast here is for bicycle people. And I know they don't want to hear it, but there are other trail users out there. And that's what always bothered me about motorized recreation on trails that were made for non-motorized.
So you feel like e-bikes is a type of motorized, like you... It's not a bicycle. It's like that next level. It's more motorcycle than bikes?
Yes.
Because of that average speed.
Yes. So
here's the weird thing about our zone here is that, well, one, we have trails that are designated as bike only, hike only, and then multi-use. So there's a whole trail system that's like very well designated. It is awesome. And so, yeah. And they're also built to be self-policing. So the trail design itself tells you, you could be on a mountain bike and go ride this hiker-only trail, but the hiker-only trail was built in such a way that it actually totally sucks to ride a bike on.
Like yeah.
Awkward corners, weird random staircases for no reasons. And then the bike trails are full of jumps and berm corners. So anyway, so there's that. But then the other weird thing about our trail system is it's everybody climbs on roads for the most part.
Yep.
So you always climb roads and then you descend trails. And the trails are already so fast that e-bikes don't even
catch up.
They can't keep up with normal bikes.
Wow.
So you actually have to work hard to get the bike fast enough to keep the trail speed.
Yeah, and average trail speeds are over 20 miles an hour in most cases.
Yeah.
Once you're pointing downhill. So it's like an e-bike just actually isn't faster. And it's just a different bike.
You know what? I think what the best point there is whoever manages the riding area, they're going to know if it's appropriate for e-bikes mm-hmm. or not. And it sounds like you guys have done a great deal. In fact, that's what I do with Gail when we're hiking. We intentionally pick trails that are not fun for mountain mm-hmm. bikers
Interesting.
Or e-bikers.
Yeah.
Because then we don't have to fight with
and
it.
And the trail polices itself that way.
Yeah.
You're not worried
just
about
like what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So this is, so you're getting into mountain bikes. By the way, again, feel free to sit.
I don't want you to be comfortable.
I feel bad.
I want to keep my voice going right into this mic. Good. I want to sound good.
You do. You know? Actually, my comment should have been like, oh my God, his voice is amazing. It's amazing. Can I tell you a story?
Of course. Way off subject.
Perfect.
My favorite all-time movie is called On Any Sunday. It's a documentary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, about motorcycles.
Yes.
Yep. So when I had Motocross Journal, for no other reason, I just wanted to do an interview with Bruce Brown, the guy who did that movie. And we went up to his place. He lives in Gaviota, just above Santa Barbara. And he said he'd give us a half hour. We stayed for 4 hours. We had such a good time with him. And so a few years later, they released On Any Sunday, the 25th year anniversary.
Yeah.
And Bruce Brown called Jimmy Mack and said, hey, would you interview me as an extra piece of this DVD?
Oh, that's so awesome.
So I had to listen to my voice compared to Bruce Brown, who has the most amazing voice you've ever heard. So, I just want to tell you.
Oh, I love that. No, thank you.
That's awesome.
No, that's good. That's a very good side knob. So, wait, so you discover this sport, basically, for yourself, too. So you start racing.
Yeah.
Right? And then when do you jump to become... like to work for Mountain Bike Action? Like, how do you hear about it? Like, how does it work? So, by the way, the reason we're asking is a lot of what we do here is the back end of how the bike industry is.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of time we talk about stuff like, how do we get stuff? How the companies get stuff? How the stuff gets made? So how does the sauce get made? Like this, how do they get to you even?
Now this will probably really upset people who've gone to journalism school and all that. But I was working at Troy Lee Designs as kind of a marketing sales guy.
Okay.
And Jody Weisel is one of my longest best friends. And he was the editor of Motocross Action magazine. And they were launching Road Bike Action. And he knew I was into road cycling. And he just came in the office one day and said, what would you think about being an editor at this?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I'm going to take you under my wing. I'm going to show you the ropes.
Who you know. It's the people you know.
And I was hesitant because, you know, when you have a really close friend and then you have to do something in business together, you're wondering, oh man, do I want to risk this friendship? And it turned out to be the opposite. Our friendship got stronger, and he was such a great mentor. And yeah, I started with High Torque, and I was there whatever 19 years, I think it was.
So you, like you said, so you were writing before? Like, how did he know that you have writing skills?
Well, just from the companies I work for in marketing positions, mm-hmm. you do press releases,
right?
You'd write the press
release. So you write the press
release. Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
And then we would do press introductions, so they got to know me from there.
Right.
And so he knew I had the ability to write, but I still had to work hard to make it worth, you know, to back up what he was telling his boss, mm-hmm. too.
So help me, all of us, understand, like, what is the job of the editor?
Oh, that's such a good question, because people don't understand.
Yeah.
It's like a director?
Yeah, they think, like, oh, do you check the spelling? Do you check
of course not.
And I'm like,
it's like everything, right?
I'm so bad at
you
that
You got to write stuff.
So what the editor does is he tries to figure out what's a good mix of stories for his potential reader. And that includes bike tests, but do you want to do all $12,000 bike tests, or do you want to do some that cost $1,500?
Right.
And when you do accessories, do you want to do all super expensive accessories, or do you want to do affordable accessories, or do you even want to do stories about how not to buy stuff, how you can make your bike last longer? And then also, I think once you have the bike, the whole thing is using it. So we did a series called Destinations, where we would pick a place like here, and which I don't think we ever did, unfortunately.
That's where I met you. Was here. It was at UBI.
Was it
bike school?
Oh, maybe
you came by the bike school. Yeah, you know Matt Eames.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think you came by the bike school to visit Matt Eames, and I met you there. Yeah.
So as an editor,
small world.
You just want to do a good mix of stories, so when someone opens up that magazine, they get excited about riding their motor, their mountain bike.
Or more, whatever it is. Right?
Yeah, or a motorcycle.
Or a road bike.
So what was the staff that you had when you were the editor?
Well,
How does it look? Because I bet some people were actually working for you. Some people are independent contractors, right? Or most of them were contractors. Right.
You know what? I really felt it was important that we generate the editorial from staff. I've never liked buying stuff outside of our crew.
Okay.
Because you didn't have the experience with them. They didn't have the experience with the products that we had. And I'm not saying I'm a great rider, but after working at a magazine for 10 years, I rode more mountain bikes. I tried more shoes. I tried more helmets than anybody else.
Ooh.
Other than another magazine guy.
It's a distracting question, but I got a question. So can you say the best mountain bike you ever rode at that point in time during your years editing, and then also followed by the worst? Or it could be the worst product or best product. I mean, this could be sensitive, but
no,
just curious.
No, I can. Something. I still remember Pivots consistently made a good mountain bike. So I always, and Santa Cruz consistently made a really good mountain bike. But one time, David Turner, who had Turner Bikes, he had a prototype of a 27.5 wheeled bike that it was before they were a thing. And I rode that up in Park City, and that was, it was the Turner Burner with 27.5 wheels, and that was just an amazing experience. That was probably the best.
Yeah.
And the worst, as I had been there, the bad bikes disappeared. Honestly.
Sure,
they've disappeared
because
you had to be making good stuff.
So, so in a world, sorry, we're going to go back and forth a little bit, obviously, because like I told you, this is made up as we go. Like, we're not, obviously, I haven't prepared for this. Should just explain to everyone. He shows up in my shop at 6:05, like, hey, we know you're closed. Do you mind if we look around? We're like, sure, but if you buy something, we like you even better. And then it's like, do you know who this guy is? And I'm like, I have no clue who the hell he is.
Is it 7:05 right now?
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, I know you.
Not
even. And then I was like, I'm going to make him do the podcast with us. So, question I have, so obviously back then there was no internet. The money, I mean, was flowing to magazines because it was the only way to introduce products, right?
Yeah.
So they have to have you and you have to have them. It's like it's a symbiotic kind of relationship where you need advertisers. So how much pressure do you get actually through the advertising piece of it from above you? Do you get pressure? Like, do you sometime ever give a review that is maybe more favorable because you know they're buying the big advertising in the middle of the magazine?
I don't think
they did. No,
I'm asking. Hey, no, conversation. Yeah.
Well, see, if you go to my motocross action, I read that every month, and they definitely don't pull any punches.
Jody is
they don't pull any punches at all.
Yeah. He's the absolute best.
No, they're yep.
But I can't think of one time where the publisher told us to pull a story. I can't remember one time when that happened. And he would have our back, but I'll tell you, if you gave a bad review, you better have your ducks in a row. You better be able to prove your opinion.
And so how do you, like, what method, I'm saying method, like, what did you use to then say, I mean, because obviously a lot of the stuff you were doing, it's your, like you said, experience. So, like, the more experience you have, the more you can talk about a product or an experience, right? The more you write, the more you know how to write about an experience. And so let's use something that doesn't exist anymore that we all hate. I'll give an example. I'll use something that we all hate. that like, I know you rode. You remember when Shimano came out with the shifters? Like, they were like the road shifters? Oh, like
brake lever shifters? What were those called?
The brake lever shifters? Nathan, come on. You know.
Dual control?
Well, dual control, but then they also had that the derailleur that would work in the opposite direction. Rapid. Well,
for that, they had a rapid rise.
Rapid rise.
It was both.
Rapid rise. No, but there was another name for it. It was like people low. Call it
backfire plus.
Low backfire.
But no, so they came out with two times. Like the first time was rapid fire. Oh no, sorry.
Rapid rise. XTR rapid rise first second.
The second
two,
time it came out, yeah. They called it low normal.
Low normal.
Because it defaulted to low
you.
Cog, right? Yeah. Versus, and then high normals default to the high cog, which is what everything does.
Second generation XTR did have the rapid rise. And then they came out with it again. Yeah.
M960.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so M950 came out with it then, and then it dropped for a while, and then they came back out with it, M960.
You know, yeah. I honestly, I just barely remember just being confused by the whole thing. just why are they doing this? Why would they do this? It's already complicated enough for most people. Why would they do that? And it didn't stick around for long. You know, another one, this kind of makes me think of it. When we rode the first 29er by Fisher Bikes, right?
Yeah, Gary Fisher, yeah.
If you look back on the review, we were not gung-ho on that. And you know, people can look back and say, see, mountain bike action, you screwed up because 29ers became the biggest thing. But if you go back and ride that first bike, the geometry wasn't wired yet. The wheels were heavy. There was very few tires available for it. So what we were telling our readers at that point was, you know, maybe you better wait a little bit on this.
It's not cooked. It's not fully cooked.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, interesting.
We can change our opinion. Then 3 years into it, we're like, these things are awesome, but they got weight off the wheels and they got the geometry fixed up. And so we didn't love everything the first ride. Let's just put it that way.
So it's amazing.
I bought a bike one time based on a review from Mountain Bike Action.
Which one was it?
GTDHI.
Oh, that was a pretty cool bike. Did you like it or did you not like it?
I loved it.
Oh, good.
I loved
it.
And the review was spot on. Like, I loved it. The thing I changed right away was it came with a Marzocchi Monster T, which is like a 12-pound fork or whatever, and I put a boxer on it. But you know, that was like the one. But the way it pedaled, the way it rode, it was ahead of its time in many regards.
You know what? I have to brag about a guy who worked for me. His name was Ryan Cleek. I think he's working. Oh, he's a marketing guy now at some bicycle company, and I should know. Sorry, Ryan, if you're listening to this. Anyway, we got a downhill bike in from GT, pretty close to when they were going close to bankruptcy, right?
Oh, so not GT Lobo, not like the when they were
Lobo was awesome. Before the
So Ryan rides this bike, and he in one afternoon, he comes back, and he goes, they spec'd the wrong shock.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no way. And he goes, yeah, they did. This shock is not valved for this suspension. So we called GT, and sure enough, they said, oh, that's the wrong shock. So I was really proud of the magazine from that standpoint. We not only caught it, but we saved a bunch of customers from getting bikes that just didn't work properly.
Huh.
And that's because of Ryan.
That's amazing. I mean, okay, so you're... Okay, so I mean, I have so many like pieces to this.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take you backwards again.
Sure.
Okay, so you worked at a road bike magazine, and then that got... closed, defunct, whatever happened with it.
Yeah, roadies. We couldn't get advertisers for that back in the day.
Okay. Like, it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And then, why did they move you to Mountain Bike Action? No, seriously. So, like, I'm trying to think as the boss. Like, so you have the boss now. Like, okay, this guy obviously couldn't make this work. And you don't always know why. Is it because of you or is it because of, like you said, couldn't get advertisers?
Yeah.
But then they say, no, he needs to move to our actually selling magazine and make it better.
Well, okay, one of my strengths was being able to get the magazine done and out on time.
Okay.
And some previous editors had issues with that.
Okay. And what was your secret? You were an editor?
Yeah, like Kurt Evans. No.
We got more people here, but they don't have a mic, so okay. I can't. It's yeah.
And my secret
we'll
for
have
that.
To one another.
Yeah, we'll do it. We do it.
My whole career had been sales and marketing. And with sales and marketing, at the end of the month, you have to hit a number, right?
Right.
And you don't just do it yourself. You need someone agreeing with you to buy a product to hit those numbers.
Sure.
So to me, that was a pretty stressful position to be in. Going to the magazine, you had 100% control over creating the product. So you didn't have that stress. As long as you paced yourself and got into the groove, I could deliver a magazine every month.
So I'm going to say you're not a procrastinator.
No,
I'm not. You can hear by the way he talks. Yeah.
You can tell, yeah. Like,
yeah.
And that comes from my sales background.
You probably would be horrible at that job.
I think if you get a really creative guy, because I never thought of myself as really creative. I think if you get a really creative guy, that's very tough to work with that type of editor. Right. Because they're creative. They don't like deadlines. And that never bothered me.
So when... I got it. So you work for Mountain Bike Action now.
Yeah.
And you're the editor.
Yeah.
And first of all, what do you change? So you get into the magazine. Obviously, they want you there for a reason, right? So what do you change in the culture to then create the Mountain Bike Action that we all know? And I'm saying that we all know. I mean, if anyone listening started biking more than 15, 20 years ago, that was the Bible. I mean, there was no other Bible.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I think all I did was took it back to its roots of product testing, product shootouts that made sense, and
you did have really
race
great
coverage.
The photos were really good.
And well, that's John Carr, man. He's a powerhouse, and he's still there to this day. He's
really?
Still shooting photos for those guys.
I mean, it worked my taste buds. Like I remember again, you're a kid, you don't have money, and you're watching these things like the. You know, what is the name? The first page of the, when you see it on a supermarket, what is it called? The first page?
Cover?
The cover. Thank you. Sorry. You see the cover, and I remember I remember the first cover that I lost my mind was actually the cover with the downhill Cannondale that had the first time they showed disc brakes, they had the Coda disc brakes on it.
Oh, nice.
And the obviously head shocks, the double, but it was a double fork. And it's like 90.
The Moto Fork?
Yeah. The probably 94. 94, maybe 95.
Moto Forks weren't
there.
Yeah,
that's
what is that?
Four Moto Forks.
I remember, but that was like, oh my. Anyway, so.
Was it a Sox disc brake or was it a Coda?
Maybe.
They did Sox before they did Coda.
Maybe. Anyway, but I remember that feeling of oh.
Yeah.
Well, so you got to see all that stuff. So were you a geek also, or you were very much business-minded? So were you a bike geek or a business-minded that became a bike geek, or you never became that bike geek?
I don't think you could call me a bike geek. I loved all the tech stuff, but I'm more of like a customer. I'm like a rider. I don't want to know how to disassemble a derailleur.
You just want to ride it and feel good.
I just want to ride it and shift it. And when does it shift? Does it shift when you let go of the paddle or when you push it in and that sort of thing? And I just want to ride the bikes. And I saw it with other publications where the guys were really good mechanically and maybe they could build a frame from scratch, okay? But I don't think that was the best angle to come at from a magazine because it's too technical. It's too advanced.
This is, by the way, our podcast is basically the opposite of what you're describing, but go ahead.
Well, it varies quite a bit.
I mean, our podcast goes consistent. From we barely speak about bikes, because we go off on some weird tantrums, to basically have an engineer conversation about atmospheric
gas
pressure
why the changes. Vent valve exists on the lower leg of a fork now.
and don't get me wrong, when hydraulics came in and all that, it was super interesting, but still at the end of the day does it work? Can you adjust it?
Is it better than what was before?
Okay, so here's a good question for someone like you now. Do you think bikes are better now? Or did they jump the shark? They became too good or basically made things?
Or are they better but just too expensive?
Or whatever. What's your thoughts on bikes now?
I'd say they're better. They're too expensive. I mean, some of the bikes, I can buy a motorcycle for less than that. And I know it's comparing apples to oranges and all that, but it's just, that's sticker shock for a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
But do you think the customer that goes buy a bike like that has a sticker shock, or by then he knows...
By then
they know the industry. You don't walk in and buy a $12,000 bike the first day you buy a bike usually.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like I mean, you can go buy a Ferrari and everyone knows how to drive
they've
it.
They've had a $2,000 bike, then a three, then a four, yeah. then six, then, you know.
They're already, like addicted. Curve. They already have the problem by the time they buy an expensive one.
But you know what? Even more about, it doesn't matter what I feel, but I've been out of the sport for like 6 years now since I left the magazine. I don't even know. I can't even keep up with it. I mean,
oh, it's geometric
in
growth.
6 years,
it's crazy.
It's,
yeah, it's
so
crazy.
Nuts.
It's crazy. Yeah.
So yeah, it's tough for me to answer that question. I'd have to buy all these magazines and go on all go on Pink Bike and all these other places and read up on everything. But I'm so off the back right now because of that.
It's do you think it's going to a good place? Like, you think the fact that the industry grew so much, is that a benefit, you think, for us cyclists, like having the support, or is it maybe? I want to give you an example, a very short example.
Yeah.
I have been, for instance, in city meetings where we try to advocate for trails, right?
Yeah.
Where we were we try to come as all of us, like we all want to support.
Show
so we
great
all,
support.
We show up. We
Mountain
show
bike
up.
Bike community comes in great support, in great
and
numbers.
Yeah. You know, they say, hey, they tell us like, hey, come support your effort, like to make trails. So three of us show up. You know,
300 of us show up.
Yeah. And then they tell us, well, the reason we didn't pass it because we were scared of you. You were all standing there.
It was intimidating.
When it was intimidating.
Too many of you there.
Too many of you there.
Yeah.
And then we send just little amount of people to not be scared. And they say, well, nobody supported it. And so I'm asking, like, is there a...
a sweet spot?
A sweet spot for the bike
industry.
What is
the sweet spot we need to find?
Like, does it make... Because I know, for instance, like, look at Marin County where they just, like, the birthplace of bikes. Now you can't ride bikes there.
Yeah.
Right? So is there, like, is this... like? I don't know. Like, what are we? Like, I'll give you an example. Like, do you remember that when Lance Armstrong, you had the yellow braces and it was kind of like a wink?
The Livestrong?
The Livestrong.
Yeah.
And if you had it at the beginning, it was like the sign that you were a cyclist. You could walk next to someone and see that and be like, that guy.
That's a
that guy.
Secret
it was
handshake.
Very savvy marketing.
It was awesome.
Very smart
and
marketing.
Then everyone had it and it sucked. It ruined everything. No, really. Do you know
but
what I
was
mean?
There one day in the middle where you're like, oh, I'm surrounded by people that are like minded, and then the next day you're like, there's too many of them.
You know, I had not heard of that situation, and that's terrible. You know, down by us, where I live in Ventura County, we're so fortunate. We just don't have trail user conflicts like they do in Marin. But I think Marin is just too many people and too small of a place.
Regardless.
Is part of it. But we all seem to get along pretty well in Ventura County. And, you know, when they have a trail maintenance day, that's when the mountain bikers show up.
Well, same here. What's funny is that, like, you know, you have people that come in and talk against mountain bikers. But then when trail day comes, guess who comes to work?
Yeah, who?
None of the hikers. Definitely none of the equestrians.
Yeah.
I mean, they just want access to everything. They never, ever, ever do any trail work.
Yeah.
I mean, just never. So, I mean, I'm asking, is there, like, is it less cool now to be a bike rider because everyone does it, or is it more cool because everyone does it?
Well, now with e-bikes, I think it's way more cool to be an e-bike rider than anybody else. They're just, they've taken over.
Wait, he's saying something.
So, I just did a little research here. So, because of the whole topic about mountain bikes being originating in, you know, the Bay Area, basically, and then... dying in that area.
Yeah.
The Sierra Club also is based in the Bay Area and was originated there too.
And?
Oh, and they are very much against mountain bikes.
Oh,
very
so you
much
think
against
there's something.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So that is their birth. Both birthplaces are in the
and
same place.
And they just bash into each other.
It
and
makes sense
Sierra
to me now.
Club
I've never
won.
Thought about it till right now. Well, they have lots more money and lots more members.
You know, the funniest thing I've ever been to when you talk about bike advocacy is in Eugene, I went out to again city meeting for planning trails, and there was like 100 of us there, right? And there was two hiker people, and we had like, there was a 2-hour meeting where they were asking questions from the audience, and the audience was asking questions from the committee, and then a couple of days later we get a notice that they did not give us what we want because the hikers didn't want it. And I thought it was the funniest thing ever. There were two people there. And it was 100 of us, and somehow the hikers won. Like, they had more hands raised up than us.
Unreal.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate to live in an area where, like I say, we all get along pretty well.
Here too, by the way.
We're pretty fortunate.
Like it's, No, this place is amazing. Yeah. I'm not saying we're trying to get more and there's some resistance and it's not a big deal. I was just asking that.
Yeah.
Cuz you seemed, I mean, you were not the birth of the mountain bike industry,
but
you were definitely in a crucial part of it. Like the real growth happened from, I want to say, the early 2000s to now. Like it's exponentially have grown.
Yeah.
It used to be, when you started, it was kind of like the crazies used to do it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then slowly, and
or
I think...
core, you could say the core. Riders.
The core. And even the products. If you look at really old mountain bike actions, there's 20 brake companies. You know, everybody who had a machine shop was making a brake for mountain bikes. Remember fork braces? That was the thing that everybody made. And... that, if I can say one thing, this is pretty funny. I did a story on fork braces, and we rigged up this thing that could measure the flex on forks with different fork braces.
Yep.
Nothing. That we're doing at RockShox, a Mag 21, if I'm not mistaken.
Love Mag 21.
Okay. Every single accessory fork brace was weaker than the Stalker. And the Stalker sold for like $6.
Oh, you're talking about you replace the bolt on.
The fork brace.
I was thinking the extra brace. The extra brace you could bolt on to the outside. The one that goes on the outside.
Because
there was a bunch of those too.
Yeah, right. And they were colorful.
Shimano made one in carbon. Yeah. It was a carbon fiber. Brace to add on to
Talking, so Quadra 21 did not have a removable brace.
No, it did. It's
the
slid
Mag
in.
21.
Oh,
did.
Mag 21. Mag 21. Sorry, the Mag 21. Yes. Yeah.
It had four little screws that held it on, and then it slipped in kind of a channel on each fork leg. And the reason I'm saying this is because that's back when Mountain Bike Action had just tons of advertising from these little tiny companies. By the time I was editor, those guys were all gone because the production stuff was so good.
So here's, I want to bring in something that Nathan and I talk a lot about and ask you your opinion about it. So, something Nathan and I discuss often is that bikes have become so good from everyone almost.
Yeah.
And with that, I feel, and Nathan sometimes agree, there's a little bit of maybe a regress in how much companies are trying new stuff, because they feel like they don't want to make a bad product, they don't want to take a risk. There was a time in the 2000s where crazy contraptions came out and but some of them gave us really good stuff. So the original idea wasn't good, but tweaks of it did become something. And something I always like to use, do you remember Manitou 1.5 head steer?
Sure
Mm-hmm. That didn't survive, but obviously all forks now have a 1.5 and they're tapered to 1 1/8, and they that was something, right?
Yeah, that was the beginning of something.
Right. So including by the way, suspension design, including VPP, by the way.
But it was Cannondale that came out with that big, huge stuff originally.
Yep.
What do you mean big, huge stuff?
1.5 was Cannondale.
Sure, you're right. Yep. They did have
that. For them, it was because head shock and aluminum frames. They had to use big tube joints because it was a pain to double over.
But it was not And then remember, Gary Fisher actually had a weird inch and...
inch and a quarter.
And a quarter.
Yep.
I have a buddy who has that because his fork was wrecked. And I go, I have a couple of forks. And he goes, no, it won't fit on my bike.
I mean, it's been amazing to see the evolutionary path of mountain bikes and just get to see the dead ends and the ones that keep evolving,
But it's really funny how they thought, one more eighth of an inch will make all the difference.
Oh, it does, though. If you go, if it engineering sure numbers.
Yeah, I know.
If you go 1 inch tube to 1 1/8, if everything else stays the same, it's double the stiffness.
Sure.
Well, same material, same wall thickness. Yep. 1/8 of an inch bigger from 1 inch is double the stiffness.
And answering your question, I think we'll still see new stuff coming.
They do come, but I noticed that a lot of new stuff that's coming, and again, it's not an argument, it's a discussion. I noticed a lot of stuff like that will be different standards, which then locks you into, which that is sometimes, I don't know that a different standard is an improvement. I want to see some crazy, weird...
I got another take on that whole thing. Because, it's kind of you have to look outside the bicycle world. And you also have to look at bicycle world history, or the history of it is like, oh, it's innovating one part that you can put into this other group of things, and it's lighter, therefore it's better, right? But now we're looking at companies that are acting more like Honda or Ford or Toyota, whatever. Like, they're making a package deal, and the only way to make things work as good as they work now is to completely engineer the entire system all together, right? And so to try to make something that's cross-compatible from a manufacturer like SRAM or Shimano's point of view, it's like, no, why would I ever want to do that to appease a few people who want to like mix and match pieces? There's no point. There is zero reason for them to want to do that, right?
Yes. I agree. So wait, I want to use our guest for so I agree with you, but I also, in the car industry, for instance, like Bosch is a big manufacturer of almost everything we touch, right? But you're right, the contact points are different between different manufacturers because of different designs.
You can interchange things between those cars.
But the system is the same. So I guess, what do you think of this? Like, do you think that's true? Like, if you look at geometry between Trek and any other bike company in the world, they, like, a trail bike is within half a degree away. The weights are the same. Like, by the way, I don't know if you noticed, you said you haven't been in the industry in 6 years, but in the last 6 years, bikes became heavier, significantly heavier. Yeah,
lots heavier.
It's really weird.
Well, they have motors now. You don't.
No. And the crazy thing is, customers come in and they pick up a 35-pound bike, and they go, oh, that's so light. And Gilad and I are just like biting our lips. We're like,
Bike that was literally 26 pounds. 6-10 years ago are now 35 pounds.
Yeah.
Same travel, nothing changed except for like a couple of tweaks in geometry. Like, you're like, you it drives us nuts.
The thing that changed is longer forks, longer lever arm, and bigger wheels, bigger lever arm there.
Excuse me. 29er. Wait, slow down.
You said 6 inch. 26 inch.
Do you remember? So 29 to 26.
Yeah. You said that's a longer leg. And again, exponential. Every time you lengthen that lever arm a little bit, it loads up the frame a lot more.
Well, trails change. We talked about that. Like, we always talk about this idea that trail change, bike change, bike change, trail change. Like, so every time the trail becomes harder, overall, bikes makes it easier to get people to be able to ride the trail, and then the trail gets harder.
Boring.
Again. Yeah.
So they make the trails harder. Then yeah.
It's oh man, I have, so how long have we been going for? All right, we are you okay?
I'm loving this.
Oh, good. I want to make sure I'm not doing it too much here with you.
No, I hope I'm not boring the crap out of you.
No. So, okay. So
what is Jimmy? What do you think?
But okay, back when I was doing it, it was all about weight. It was, mm-hmm. and keeping it off the bike. And as I got older, that's almost all that mattered to me, because it was really hard to get a bike up a hill that was over 30 pounds. So to hear that people are taking a 35-pound bike up, you know, a long climb, it's pretty amazing. Unless the tire technology and wheel technology has answered some of that, has taken out some of
that.
They're
heavier, too.
The hurt.
They're heavier, too, by far.
But if it performs better on a climb, I don't know. And same with,
let me tell you,
same
something
with the
about
whole
physics.
Drivetrain thing.
Let me tell you something about physics. Rotational weight physics have not changed because of...
I think, here's what I think. I think it's the attitude of the riders changed. They're no longer racing to the top of the hill. That's
the enduro rider
part.
Is now a thing.
They're just getting there. Yep. They're just winching their way up the hill. They're
and
just
then
getting
they complain
there.
And pass
and then it's rocketing down the hill. It's all about the... It's 90% of the bike is designed for 10% of the ride.
Yep. Yes.
That's what it is now.
Back when you were talking about proprietary products where you have to buy into the GT thing or the Specialized thing, and you have to go with their technology. You know, it's not something you can swap out in the future, like the Brain Shock.
What do you thought of that when they came out? Was that a huge... I mean, I remember that. That felt really good to me.
It wasn't
as compliant.
I thought it felt good. Now, when we used to kind of counsel people, just know that it's proprietary and you're stuck with it. Someone's not going to come out with an accessory shock for that bike. And I think we all think of our mountain bikes lasting longer than they do. So it's not like a lifetime decision. I mean, maybe you guys have said it. You always say, this is the last bike I'm buying.
No, God, no.
This is going to last me the rest of my life.
You do not know us.
That doesn't happen.
In the last 6 months, I had, what, four new bikes?
Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous.
So that's why I softened on the proprietary stuff, because if you don't like it, sell it and get something you like. Yep. You know, it's not, you're not going to take that big a hit on it.
So is that maybe what, so, you know, the bike industry obviously came from having to adapt to whatever was out there, right?
Yeah.
And then slowly being able to make proprietary stuff for themselves, right?
Where, what are you, how far back, what, what's your origin here?
I'll give an example, like tires, 26, part of it was like, big tires came
early out. Mountain bike stuff.
Early mountain bike. Okay. And then they use a lot of like motorcycle bars and brake levers to get the leverage right.
Yeah.
And then slowly the industry grows, right? And then as it grows, we start having more proprietary bike specific stuff. I mean, to the level, by the way, 27.5 was the, I felt like was the first like industry new standard. Like they had to bring new molds. They have to like change the way they think about.
Yeah.
Who was the guy? It starts with a D, I think, that was really pioneering 27.5 before it was a thing.
I know who you're talking, about. And he was super nice to me.
I keep trying to think of his name, and it's a D something.
I had that attitude of, oh man, just what we need, another wheel size. You're just going to confuse consumers, and this is so stupid. And then I fell in love with them.
I remember writing 27.5 for the first time, and I was like, I knew this is going to be it. And
but on paper, I didn't think that the sport needed another wheel size. You know, but later, like I say, I warmed up to them. And I always felt if there had never been a 26-inch wheel or a 29-inch wheel, if we had just started with 27.5,
I remember that article.
That would probably be the only size
wheel I remember that,
we'd ever have.
There was an article about that.
Yeah.
I remember that article where they talked about, like, if we had the ability, like, if the sport...
Go back in time and just
go back in time and make one from scratch, 27.5 would have been one. I actually remember that article. Was that your article or...
You know, that was my opinion, but I'm sure I wasn't the lone person with that opinion.
No, sure, but the article
write about that.
It's wow, that's so amazing. So, do you remember, for instance, like, I'm guessing your first carbon bike experience? Like, was that a big deal? Or what's the first really good disc brakes you rode?
You know,
was it like the Avon Mechanical or
what? I would have to say that when, you know, we got that stuff early. That when you say carbon frames, we got carbon frames way before shops had them. Same with disc brakes. And they weren't that good. Like, there was a lot of flex in carbon frames.
Sure.
The bottom brackets would be moving around, or you go into a corner and you couldn't control it. Same with titanium. A lot of the titanium parts were downright scary to ride at first. But, okay, we're just talking about the very beginning. So you don't like them in the very beginning. But then the second or third generation, you're like, okay, they're delivering on the promise.
So what was like the first carbon bike you rode and felt like that was a jump?
Mm.
Like, I know what it is for me, but I don't know what it is for you.
I honestly don't remember.
For me, by the way, it was a Santa Cruz, the first Blur LT, right? That was their first carbon frame. And I rode it an inner bike, and I could not believe like how good that bike was. I was blown away.
But now, tell me if I'm wrong, but Santa Cruz was late to the game on the carbon thing, weren't they?
Not sure. I think they were actually the first.
If you compare, like, if you say like Trek OCLV for road bike stuff, they were out there pretty early on.
I felt like they had they were hardtails, I think, made out of carbon.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. like...
And not taking anything away from them, but what I think is they learned from other people's mistakes.
Sure, they monetized. Mm-hmm. I felt like Santa Cruz made carbon, like, not accessible,
you know what they did more than anything? They made it trustworthy.
Yes, indestructible. They That's exactly the word I was about to use. Yeah,
they made it acceptable. They made it. They bridged the gap between it being questionable and like, oh, it's carbon, I don't know, to it's aluminum, I don't know. Carbon is indestructible. They did that.
Yeah.
The Pink Bike article that was on there, they did that.
Do you remember riding that bike?
No.
Or do you remember the Pink Bike article?
Would you go to ride an Interbike or not? That wasn't interesting to you because by then you knew everything.
Oh, no. We went to Interbike, and that's more just to see new stuff. Interbike, it lost a lot of its sheen because it used to be you'd walk some of the back aisles and you would find some new products from guys and be so stoked.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
By the way, we talk about Interbike here. I always talk about, Nathan too, right? You say the same. The big booth didn't interest me because I knew I'm going to see them.
Yeah.
I would go and look for that dude sitting next to a picnic table with like some weird thing and have a conversation with him. A, he was happy to talk to you because nobody would. And B, sometimes it was like amazing stuff.
Exactly.
Like, just like, wow. Like, you make this and you have to get his business card and then you call him and he's not available because he has a real job somewhere else. But he made something really cool.
Yeah.
And, oh, that was so awesome. And
from a magazine standpoint, I mean, what could be better? You're not testing the product. You're just saying to your readers, hey, check this out. You got to see what this guy did.
Yeah.
And they might say, that guy's crazy. Or they might say, I'm glad you put the number in there. And that's something I used to do. We used to put the telephone numbers in the captions.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
For people to call the,
I don't remember that.
The guy. Well, because it helped the magazine. If, let's say you're making a fork brace. And all of a sudden you get 20 calls. You're like, well, where'd you get this number? And they, oh, Mountain Bike Action. So this is pre-internet days, mm-hmm. guys.
Yeah.
So, that's how people knew our magazine was working for them.
How many, I just came up with this question. How many companies you think were made because of you guys? So basically, meaning this was a nobody person, and or a company or this, like, how many companies were created because of a good review from you guys? You think? Because they must have come back to you, like, we want to advertise with you now. Because look, you made us, like, all these people got to us because of you.
The one that pops into my mind first. There's two. Okay. I think Santa Cruz. When we did the Super Light, isn't that what it was called? Their aluminum cross country bike.
Yeah, that was the Super Light. Yeah,
and we loved that bike. And I think
great bike.
I think not that we put them in, but I'm sure that helped them a lot getting that coverage. And then,
so how small? How small were Santa Cruz at the time of Super Light? That one bike.
I don't know. Technically, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not that big.
If you had gone to Sea Otter, though, you would swear that they had a 60% market share. Yeah. So many people were riding Santa Cruz's up there.
Well, it's so close to that place.
Yeah.
Also.
I used to kid with Rob about that. Dude, if you just came here and you don't know anything about the bicycle industry, you would think you guys are as big as Specialized right now. But that's because it was, you know, Northern Cal. That was their place. But the other company was, first it was Titus, and then Titus, the owner, sold and started Pivot. Yeah, Crisco Callis.
Oh, okay.
And he started Pivot. And let's just say we had a good relationship with both his companies, and he made great products. And I think we went a long way of putting him on the map for sure. But if you don't have a good product, no magazine, no website's going to put you on the map.
No,
you got to back it up.
For sure. No, of course. Like, yeah. But what I was, again, you've said it, but like, what was products that you remember that were, you know, less known, and then the magazine basically created some clout because saying something good about it, and then this company coming back and saying, hey, we want to advertise with you because last time you said something about us made a huge difference to us, and we're growing, and we're adding product, and like, that, did that happen a lot or not so much?
Now you're going to think I'm just trying to take the company line, but I'm not. I've been out of the company for 7 years or whatever. But honestly, I didn't check who was advertising.
Really?
I swear. I will swear on a Bible if you have a Bible here.
I don't think it's bad. It's funny. I actually think that the advertisers are part of how you make decisions of what articles to write. Not because of them pushing you to do it, but because they want to have the product reviewed. And when you review their product, they probably will want to put an advertising for their product, right? It just benefits to them.
You know, that was up to the ad guys. I mean, I let them handle that.
Oh, so you write the articles and say, hey, we're writing about whatever, new pivots. And they would contact Pivot and say, hey, we're writing an article about you.
And that's so funny you say that, because I would beg them not to do it in the same issue. Because, you know, like, we're doing a review on the bike, okay?
It's enough.
Right.
If there's an ad in there, they're going to say, oh, well, they just liked it because they ran an ad.
The next
you know?
Page is an ad on the bike.
and also, I can think of one product we didn't like. It was just a little component. And he ran an ad, the same issue, and we gave it like one star. You know, he said, don't buy this. And there's an ad in that issue. You know, he would have been better off waiting for that to die down and putting an ad in.
You know, you should totally do like, you know, people say like not all advertising is good advertising kind of thing. You know, people think like, oh, any advertising is a good one. Like, no, a one-star review was not a good advertising.
But I'll tell you when I was upset is when the mail order ads started to disappear. And I watched it. That was during my tenure.
Why is that? What did internet upset you? Oh, because of the internet. Yeah. So you got upset because...
Well, just if you look at when I first started editing Mountain Bike Action, there was 25 pages of mail order ads.
Yeah.
25 or 30. And that I'm not taking credit for that. That's all the editors who were before me. And so they had built that up. But then as the internet became more powerful, they felt it was way more cost efficient to do stuff on websites than in the magazine, and it just dried up. And well, I always knew
obviously they were right.
The one good thing that happened is Mountain Bike Action had lost the support of a lot of the big manufacturers, and when I was editor, we got a lot of them back in the book.
And what do you think?
We were just more consistent. If like you knew what you were getting from Jimmy Mack. You knew that it was going to be so many tests, there was going to be so many product tests, we'd have a destination story, we'd have some race coverage. You could depend upon what was going to be in the issue. Prior to that, it was a little bit more freestyle. You didn't know what was going to be in there.
So what's your, do you have a take? Do you, because I think we're just, we did an hour. That's pretty good.
Dudes, that went by so fast.
I know, right?
This is so fun. Thank you for having me.
We don't edit either.
Because you were like, oh, I'm not going to talk. I don't know anything.
I haven't stuttered much at all. Huh?
No. And of course, I'm respectful for your time. You're visiting your friend here. I don't want you to feel like we're just pulling you out of like
what because
you
we could.
we could. I mean, and you don't know me yet. You know me for about 20 minutes more than this podcast has been running. Trust me, I can talk all day.
I feel like we're old friends.
No, he can't talk all day.
I can talk all day. Nathan can't do it, but I'm very much.
But can I tell an athlete talking? Can I tell all you riders out there,
bro?
If you're on your computers tonight or on your phone or whatever, look at Jimmy Mack on Two Wheels, and it's spelled out. That's my website. I don't sell anything there. I don't track you when you come. I have no idea that you've looked at it. You can send me an email, and I do stuff about anything on two wheels, motorcycles, e-bikes, bicycles, and it's kind of fun.
No, actually, I didn't want you to close it off. I just wanted to ask you, like,
oh,
what, like,
but that's good.
That's fine. It's great. You should go to his website and do all that stuff. You know, it's great. You do it again afterwards. Actually, what I wanted to ask you just as a you know, you've done it for 20 years. You were there,
yeah,
in the magazine,
yeah,
like. This is such a cheesy question what I'm going to ask you, so please don't hate me. But like, for 20 years you did something. What have you learned from it? Like, meaning as you as a person, what have you learned about, like, what, how did it change you to do the job that you did? And if it's related to bikes, great. If not, I just want to hear about it, because you obviously touch a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, and obviously your magazine that you ran was a huge part, especially before the internet, but it doesn't matter. It brought us to the internet age, right? It brought the sport from obscurity to the fact that now this sport supports a lot of people, including my family.
Obscurity in Safeway shelves, you know, like
Safeway's, not just Safeway shelves, but I mean, like, obscurity, like mountain biking was, you know, rollerblading at the beginning. Like, it was like some bunch of weird people were doing this weird thing, right?
Yeah.
And somehow it became this mainstream, right, where people want to be part of it. And so what have changed in you through the years, and kind of like, what did it bring you? I don't know, like, what does it feel like, anything, being a part of this industry?
Oh, it sure does. I think, to answer your question, once you get to spend that much time at something, you get some experience, and I can look back. Maybe not the first few stories I did.
Sure.
But the last few stories I did, I'm very proud of. And I think they were balanced. I think they were fair. We didn't pull punches, so I'm very proud of that. And I think that's what I learned. And what scares me about media today in general is that there's a lot of people who don't have much experience at it. And I'm not saying they won't become great riders some days, writers and riders, but it takes some time. And I'm so fortunate that High Torque gave me that time to get the experience to really put together a good product.
See, like, there's a whole, like, line of questions now that I want to ask you, but I'm not.
Okay.
because it could keep on going. Because basically every time you say something, you open up this subject, yeah. Right? Like, that I can ask you a bunch of stuff about. And like I said, I want to be respectful of your time. And how about this?
But did that make sense to you?
It makes a lot of sense to me. I guess I wanted more of, like, did you even recognize that what you were doing is something that's changing, like, literally all of our lives? And I'm saying all of us is because, first of all, I think anyone who's listened to this crazy podcast is pretty much into biking. They're not just a little bit, they're a lot.
Yeah.
But also because, like, the fact that biking is what it is today, like I said, before the internet, you were our internet. So if you were today, I wake up in the morning and I have like two or three websites. The first thing I do is I go and read bike news, right? You were it. You were my Bible, like I said.
And here's another aspect of that too. The internet cheapens things now. Like when Mountain Bike Action came out, it was like a once a month. You're like, oh, and it's here's coming. The day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God, the day. The future is today, you know? Yes. And then 30 more days would go by, or maybe 31, or maybe like whatever it was.
And you would read it multiple times and always find something new. Like this new ad come pops at you, or this picture suddenly makes a difference for you, or like you look at it. Like, here's the other thing. It was watching some of the pictures or some of the stories were very much like a book where you build a world in your brain, right? Because you don't really, there's nothing moving, right? Like if you're talking about like an event that happened, that the big jumps, like there's like one picture of a jump.
Right.
And then like
a description of it though.
And then to take yourself from like seeing that to then saying, I'm going to try that. Like this again, it's an evolution of the sport. Part of it is us young kids, we're watching it and like aspiring for something, if it's things or if it's ability to do something.
Yeah.
And I always use like, you know, what the first time I watched Crank 2, whatever, I think first movie I ever watched that had like
on VHS
free riding, of course. Like it blew my mind. I was like, and all I wanted to do is put motorcycle, you know, stuff on me and go jump stuff.
Yeah.
Which hug off of.
Yeah, I hugged up things. Like I would walk the bike up a rock and there's like all of us, like five of us, were like, rah, 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 and then one of us jumps, doesn't crash or kind of crashes. And it was like, rah, it was great.
You know, Bender got a start here in Ashland.
Well, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, of course. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
Bender was, from here apparently. Here. I mean, you wouldn't think of him as a writer, but somehow he was a hero for all of us.
He pushed the bounds.
But was he a good writer? Could he write down?
He was brave. He was not very brave.
I asked if he was a good writer.
Honestly, I never rode with him. I can't tell you.
And it was pre-Strava. Like, you wouldn't even know.
Basically.
But back to the influence of the magazine. We used to do a lot of like 100 tips. Do you remember those stories?
Yeah.
Where some would be mechanical, some are riding tips and all that. And I used to get feedback from experienced guys. You say, come on, we know that stuff. And I go, okay, but what about your neighbor who's just getting into this? Isn't that going to help him? And they go, yeah, I guess you got a point there. Yeah, it's good for beginners. So that's what we tried to do too. And I think we did a pretty good job of that and doing a lot of shootouts at entry-level bike prices. I think that helped the sport a lot because you got to start somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I'm sorry. I'm going to stop it because I need you to come again.
Oh.
Okay? Like, it's just whenever you have time and you go by Ashland, now you know where we are. You can find us.
Yep. I love Ashland. I love this town.
You literally have to give me, as you can see, a 5-minute notice. And we'll figure it out. Like, it's not hard. Okay.
Yeah, you say that. Wait till you get feedback. That Jimmy Mack.
I get
a jerk.
No feedback. Like, trust me. I get like, the things I get feedback back from our listeners is the most hilarious stuff. It's the things, like, we try really hard, I get nothing. And then we do something really dumb, and someone will, like a month later, will give me some weird feedback about it. I was like, what are you talking about even? And it's like, it's a point of, like, someone came to me not long ago and was like, how do you like your shifter? And I was like, what? Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, oh, you were talking about your shifter. And I'm like, when was I talking about my shifter? It's like, oh, in your podcast, like 3 months ago. I was like, that's so random. Yeah. I don't know.
That musician who played the other day, he found us because of the podcast.
Yes, it was really weird. Yes, yes. We had a musician.
Anyway. I'll know how it plays out if I call you in a couple of months and say, "Hey, I'm coming through town." Oh, you know, Jimmy. No, we don't. We're really busy now.
Busy that day.
I don't think we need you.
Washing my hair. I'm washing my hair that day. No, we love it. And like I said, I everything you've said today made me want to ask more questions.
Oh, cool.
And because again, I know you're doing something that everyone that is put under the spotlight does, which is saying, I didn't do it. It was like an effort, team effort. It was. And a lot of time we don't look back at what we've done and actually recognize what it is. And so what we try to do here in the podcast when we have people is ask people questions that slowly, either they recognize it or not, makes us pull out those things that made these things important, right?
Yeah.
And so you might not see it. Like, you were just doing something. You didn't think anything of it. But obviously, it influenced the industry, influenced us. Your writers, the way you picked them is interesting.
Shaped things.
Yeah.
You really did shape things. And mm-hmm. and really, you built, you made the ground floor for what the internet is now. Right.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, you did such a good job that, I mean, really, if you think of all the successful website, that what are they? They're Mom Bike Action.
Just in updated the form, every 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's all. So I want to say thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Are you kidding me? Listen, this short Israeli dude that you met like 10 minutes before this podcast like attacked you by saying, "Can I push a microphone in your face?" And you said yes. So... 100%. Well, thank you so much.
I had a blast, and I would love to do it again if
good.
Your listeners don't hate it.
I don't care. Okay. I do it a lot of it for ourselves. We enjoy it, right, Nathan? Like, it's for us. Yeah.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll try to put some pictures on this. Thank you, everyone.